Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to Viet History Makers with my co-host, Kevin Pham. We talked about being so committed to what we do, and I want to always introduce you as somebody who puts a lot of work into these episodes, and we commonly ask for help, donations, on our YouTube channel as it refers to the Viet History Maker. So can you give that introduction to how our audience can donate?
These episodes take work, and I do them at a cafe typically. I write them out and I do research for them. And so if you have been enjoying these episodes, feel free to buy us a super thanks, get me a coffee. That'll also give us some moral encouragement.
We are going to be talking about Đào Duy Anh. And I thought to myself, that's a lot of work. It's like very tangential. This is a very different figure from who we normally. And I thought about your time spent researching this person. So I wanted to give you that. And also now I want to ask, why this person? And this is not typically who we would spotlight.
Yeah, great question. So I did not know much about Đào Duy Anh. The reason I knew of him is through my interest in the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng movement. And I'll talk more about that today. But to put it really simply, he is such a towering intellectual figure in Vietnam. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't know more about him. I wrote a whole book about six influential Vietnamese thinkers. Well, he is such a significant thinker. I mean, let me just say a few things here. He's a historian of Vietnam. He won the Ho Chi Minh Prize in 2000, and that's the most prestigious award that you can win in Vietnam. So he won it for his contributions to science, literature, art, technology. He wrote really famous works such as The History of Vietnam, From Its Origins to the 19th Century, a book called Ancient History of Vietnam, another one called The Outline of Vietnamese Cultural History, and Vietnam Through the Dynasties. So he wrote a lot. He was also a geographer. He was a linguist. He was a lexicographer. So he made dictionaries. He made a Chinese-Vietnamese dictionary in 1932. He made a French-Vietnamese dictionary in 1936. Let me just pause for a second and say how important it is that a country like Vietnam has dictionaries like this. I mean, you have to keep in mind that this is French colonialism. The Vietnamese had been using the Chinese language. This was around the time that Quốc ngữ was just being developed, and he is taking part of it. I mean, he is influencing the Vietnamese language, you know? He was also an encyclopedist. He was also a philosopher. He wrote about Confucianism. And so he influenced the fields of sociology, of economics, of political science, of social studies in Vietnam. I mean, he is so important. And one other interesting thing is that I found out that in April of last year, 2024, there was a big conference in Hanoi with over 100 academics, philosophers, professors from all around Vietnam to do a conference celebrating his 120th birthday. So
that's impressive. Yeah. You know, I have two funny things to add to this conversation. I don't know if you know this, but there is a saying, jack of all trades and master of none, right? But you know that's not the complete saying, right?
And this what is it?
And this actually applies to Daozian. There's a full saying in English, jack of all trades, but master of none is better than the master of one. Could be better, is oftentimes better than master of one.
Really? So
it's a three-part saying. So let me say it again. Jack of all trades is, I'm so sorry. I'm so early in the morning right now. Jack of all trades, but master of none, oftentimes is better than the master of one. So this applies to Daozian. So that's the first funny thing. The second thing I actually, to do a little research for this person, I looked up the actual vocabulary count of Vietnamese and American English. And the numbers are pretty staggering. According to ChatGPT, the Vietnamese language has about 80 to 100,000 words, right? But what people actually use is only 20 to 30,000 words. The American English has roughly about 1 million words. Pretty intense. But what's actually used is only 20 to 35,000 words. So the number is, there's a big variation. So we can't pinpoint it. But we're looking on the magnitude of maybe 6 to 8 times. I'm going to have Professor John Pham from Columbia on sometime this week. And we're going to dig into, hopefully we can bring over some information that you and I talk about with this extraordinary Daozian. So those are the facts I wanted to kind of insert here.
And by the way, I'm excited for that episode that you're going to do with John Pham. I mean, I'm looking forward to reading his new book, Lost Tongues of the Red River. Shout out to John. Okay, let's get started. So let me just lay out the structure of what I'd like to discuss today. So first, I want to talk about the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng, because the reason why we're talking about Daozian is to also talk about this really important moment in Vietnamese history. And we've mentioned the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng before, which is, for the listener who doesn't know, was what I would call a free speech movement in North Vietnam. And then I'm going to move on to Daozian. I'm going to talk about him and his life, so give a brief biography. And then what I really want to explore with you, Ken, is him and his involvement in the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng and what he says, because this is the most important thing. He's going to argue that Vietnamese academia is backward and poor. And the reason for why it's backward and poor is because the political party leaders do not trust the intellectuals and scientists. And so the discussion we're going to have is what should be the proper relationship between intellectuals and political leaders.
Wow, there's a lot of parallels with the modern world. Huge. This is
I'm not going to say anything about the modern world, but we're talking about deal here.
But you know, I mean, don't you have to burn books and kill intellectuals and rob them of their jobs if you're really going to find a way to control people?
That's a question that we'll engage. Let's keep that in our heads. So let's go through some context, and then we'll get into these interesting philosophical important questions. Okay, the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng, what was that? Well, when we think of Vietnamese victory over anti-colonial struggle, we think of how the Vietnamese defeated the French at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. This is a huge moment, not just for Vietnamese people, but for anti-colonial activists all around the world. Malcolm X is going to cheer on the Vietnamese. He's going to say, look at what the Vietnamese did in 1954, in May of 1954. Frantz Fanon is going to say the same thing. He's going to write, how do we create more Dien Bien Phu's? If you look all around the world, anti-colonialists are going to look to Vietnam. They're going to cheer. However, this focus on Dien Bien Phu leaves blurred in the background something else, something that reminds us that freedom is rarely a singular achievement. Rather, freedom is a constant struggle. What a lot of people in the world don't know is that in the few years leading up to Dien Bien Phu, Vietnamese communist revolutionaries were also struggling against another opponent, an internal opponent, Vietnamese landlords, people they perceived as the landlords. So this is during what we call a land reform campaign. We've talked about this on this series, but just to remind listeners, this was between 1952 and 1956 in the North, and the communist revolutionaries are taking land from perceived landlords, redistributing it to poorer peasants. And this struggle did not produce a clear victory, but they will say it led to some victory, but its own leaders admitted publicly to making mistakes and committing excesses and unjust persecution. So they will admit to this. And another important thing here is that this moment also leads to a kind of disenchantment among those who supported the communist revolution. And it starts to break down at the solidarity that had been built over the years. And at this point, I do want to pause and say something I find really interesting. And I didn't get a chance to do this in the last episode, but in the last episode, Ken, we were talking about the five generals and one soldier from South Vietnam. And in South Vietnam, in so-called anti-communist South Vietnam, there was a similar land reform campaign. It was called the Land to the Tiller Program, Người Cày Có Ruộng. This was between 1970 and 1973. It was essentially the same thing as the land reform up north. The idea was to redistribute land to the poor and landless. Like the designers read Lenin. And even some of the people in the South, they took issue with the name because it sounded too communist. But essentially the South knew that if they wanted support from the peasants, they need to control the rural population. They need to get on the side of the peasants here. Don't you think that's kind of ironic? You have the North and the South doing the same thing.
This podcast is sponsored by Delete Me. Would you just give your house key to criminals? Having your personal information on the internet is like giving a thief the key to your home. They can take everything that's valuable to you anytime. But join DeleteMe.com can help you protect yourself. Online data brokers compile information about you and sell it to people who could ruin your life. But JoinDeleteMe.com scours the web, removes the personal information you don't want seen, and reduces the risk of data brokers, scammers, identity thieves, even political enemies getting personal information that could hurt you, your family, or your reputation. You'll get regular reports detailing what they find and remove. And JoinDeleteMe.com isn't just AI. They have real people working to keep your data safe. Keep your private life private with JoinDeleteMe.com. Sign up today and get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to JoinDeleteMe.com/protect. Go to JoinDeleteMe.com/protect. That's JoinDeleteMe.com/protect.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
But you know, it's funny when I hear this, and I've heard it before, But is the zeitgeist at the time dictating, hey, let's redistribute land? And then the other question I have is, as I'm hearing it, how much of it actually went to poor people? How much of this redistribution get to poor people? Or is it a bunch of guys who are saying, all right, in the name of communism and land reform, we're gonna take away your land, but we're going to keep it for ourselves?
Are you talking about the North or the South?
The North.
Oh, the North. Well, I mean, we can't answer these questions now. These are empirical questions that require, you know, historians and studies.
Yeah, it's a rhetorical question for me. I think about that. Like, how much was actually given to poor people or peasants? Did they actually do what they said? And now, you know, I question in the South that they actually get the lands to the peasants.
Yeah. So in the South, the land reform was apparently created by Gao Van Thun. And it's often seen as an idea from the United States, but I'm reading more and people are saying actually it was the idea of the Minister of Land Reform, Gao Van Thun. Anyway, that's a side note, interesting thing there. Okay, back to the North. So the leaders of the land reform apologize. Wang Wenzhap gives a famous speech doing that. You can find it online. And they also encourage their comrades to speak openly about where the party went wrong and how they might improve. So this is in the ethos of criticism and self-criticism. We've talked about this before, but for communist revolutionaries like Mao Zedong and Stalin, they kept talking about the need to criticize and self-criticize. That's how you purify yourself as a revolutionary. So in response to this, there was a group of Vietnamese who, by the way, these Vietnamese are sympathetic to the communist revolution. They air their criticisms of the party through essays published in two journals, Nhân Văn, Masterpieces, and Giải Phóng, Humanities. So this period of public criticism in the North is known as the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng movement between 1955 and 1960. Now, should we call them dissidents? Some people have called them that, and historians and myself, we think that's wrong to call them dissidents, because if you call somebody a dissident, then you're suggesting that they disagree with the ideology of those they're opposing. But they do not oppose the party's official ideology. Many of the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng members explicitly embrace socialism and communism. So, you know, they're doing friendly critiques, you know, critiques from the inside. They're not like capitalists. But of course, capitalists will use their arguments against the communists. So the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng participants, a lot of them had devoted themselves to anti-colonial struggle. Some of them sacrificed their property, their families' buildings for the cause. Some of them fought side by side with peasants in the jungle against the French. And these are intellectuals who are devoting themselves. And they believe that, okay, now that we kicked out the French, national independence means that it's time to promote creative individual expression, right? Relax, experiment with freedom of speech. Now, what's really interesting to me is that if you read their writings, they often argue for intellectual freedom and freedom of speech. Well, let me ask you this, Ken. In the United States today, when people argue for free speech, what kind of argument do they make? How do they defend free speech?
That's a great question. I don't think most of us think about it. I think when I get asked that question from you right now, I think the main argument is you can say whatever you want as long as you don't slander or put down somebody in a way that is false and hurts somebody's reputation. Otherwise, ideas could be put out there for debate and you could say anything against the government or anybody.
Right. I'm looking for a word that starts with an R. They argue for it in terms of rights. They have a right to free speech. This language of rights is a specific liberal rights framework. Again, I don't mean liberal to mean left here. I mean liberal as in individual freedom. That is the ideology of the so-called West. And it's in terms of inalienable right that I, as an individual, have a right to free speech. That's how we in the United States argue for free speech. We say, hey, I have a right. It's my First Amendment, right? This is not how the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng argue for free speech. They do not appeal to rights.
Interesting.
It's even more interesting. They argue that free speech can help them generate power to get to socialism.
Wow. How backwards.
And not even like, yeah, backwards as in like different, right?
Yeah.
Not backwards as in like bad, but like,
no,
it's a very different way of defending free speech.
Yeah, you're going about it the in reverse. You know, let's get some rights going on so we can clamp down on what you can say.
Well, we'll talk more about that. But they're going to say that free speech can generate a kind of social and political power. And by this, they mean solidarity, consensus, fellow feeling, in order for the Vietnamese to transition to socialism.
Kevin, I got to stop you. As I'm listening to you and I'm putting on my American hat, it feels, you know, yeah, that makes sense logically. But when I put on my like Vietnamese sort of like upbringing hat, it feels unnatural for me to just say whatever I want. It's kind of in the cultural water that we drink. It's like we have to be very measured. We have to really think about the things we say. And, you know, it's kind of like there's forces holding us back when I think about putting my Vietnamese hat on. And that's just from my upbringing and seeing the way the conversation flows within my family and my societal structure.
Ken, this is really interesting. If we're thinking about the meaning of free speech, let's take a really quick detour here about the concept of free speech. I'll tell you this, there's no single society on planet Earth that allows for unlimited speech. Free speech is never absolute. Even the most absolute you can get is in the United States, where it's very special compared to other countries. But even in the United States, there are things, as you mentioned, that you cannot say. You cannot slander. You cannot shout fire in a crowded theater, etc. But in most societies, there are limits to free speech. And the real question becomes, when should speech be limited? Even in the United States, I mean, let's go back to there are certain laws. When the country is at war, for example, there are certain laws where you cannot say just about anything, right? So all countries, all societies limit speech somehow. But all societies, even if you look at the constitutions of what we would call authoritarian societies, all give some lip service, at least, to free speech. But even in countries like, say, China, they will, and I've studied this, they will allow for a certain amount of free speech for strategic reasons. So one theory is what they call the steam valve theory, that if you don't allow people to say some stuff, then they're going to get really angry and it's going to be more dangerous for you as a government, right? So if you want to keep your control, you better allow for a little bit, you know? Yeah. But it is interesting that you always are making decisions about how to limit speech. For example, if we had a bunch of people in a room right now, everybody cannot speak at the same time. We couldn't hear each other. There has to be rules and procedures. You have to decide who can speak first, right? If a politician is giving a speech on a college campus and then students shout him down, you still have to make the decision of who can speak first, right? So speech is always being regulated, always being limited in certain ways. We just need to figure out how and when, right? So that's one point that I want to make. And so the right to free speech does not ever mean the right to say anything that you want, even in the most pro-free speech societies. Okay, so the Nyanvanzaifam participants, as I had mentioned, they're trying to now transition to socialism. And this is interesting because, believe it or not, listener, Karl Marx was a huge proponent for free speech. If you actually read his writings, he is writing in the context of a very autocratic, authoritarian Prussian state. They are very much going to crack down on labor movements and so on. So Karl Marx sees free speech as a tool to help workers win power to fight the capitalists. Karl Marx is convinced that if the workers were just able to communicate with each other, then they could unite and overthrow capitalism. So he thought free speech was really necessary. Anyway, so the Nyanvanzaifam is similar to a movement that many listeners will probably be familiar with that's happening in China, which is known as the Hundred Flowers Movement. So the Nyanvanzaifam is actually a little before that movement. The Hundred Flowers Movement is similar because the Communist Party there is encouraging citizens to speak openly about the party. And they're all inspired by what's happening in Eastern Europe because Stalin dies in 1953. And so there are all these currents of reform communism or de-Stalinization in the Eastern Bloc. So these people are beginning to call for free speech, human rights, rule of law, democracy, etc. And so these writings are, again, they're meant to be internal, directed at their own comrades and leaders, not at the anti-communist world. So, okay, one more thing about the Nyanvanzaifam that I find interesting is that, and I want to talk to you about this, Ken. I think this is interesting, and I want to know what you think about how this differs from, say, the United States. So the Nyanvanzaifam and the communists, they're very clear that they have a social goal, and that goal is 社会主义, socialism, that ensures 幸福国人民, happiness of the people. They're always saying that. They're always saying, that's our goal, happiness for the people. And I think this is really clever. And the reason is because once you set up a goal that everybody agrees on, then you can debate how to get to the goal, right? No one will question the goal. Like they can't imagine somebody saying, I'm against the happiness of the people, right? So you're allowed freedom of speech to get to the goal. You're allowed, but you're not allowed the freedom to say, I'm against the happiness of the people. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Like in the United States, are you allowed to say, I'm against, I mean, like there, I feel like there are things in the United States that you would not be allowed to say. Like, you cannot say, let's bring slavery back.
Right.
Like you are technically allowed to say that by law, right? But like in Germany, you know, you cannot do a Hail Hitler sign.
Right, right. But you could do it on the inauguration here, I heard.
So these are the things about America. So actually in the United States, you are legally allowed to do these things. But if you, for example, if you're a professor in a college classroom, in a public university, and you say certain things that are against the values of the nation, I mean, you're gonna encounter trouble, right?
But you know, Kevin, I do want to comment on this, and I think the deal is this. I think when I think about communication in back in those days, I think happiness, even to today, when you think about happiness in Vietnamese society, it's about the ability to make money, the ability to provide for your family. And I think communication that helps with stacking up cash and being able to pursue your career in making money is a thing that we should talk about. We should always be open and communicate how to, but the minute you express, I think something that seems a little bit dissenting. I think it goes against the grain of the Vietnamese culture or the Asian culture. You're rubbing up against elders, and I think that's kind of what I feel about Vietnamese culture sometimes and Asian cultures is, you can say anything you want, you know, let's communicate more. Let's figure out ways to make more money. Let's figure out ways to empower our people. But I think the true form of self-expression in the way the Americans challenge each other within society is where it gets really uncomfortable.
Well, this is all very interesting. I mean, you mentioned Vietnamese culture. What's interesting is that Confucianism is no doubt very much a part of Vietnamese culture. And Confucians do have a tradition that I would not call free speech, but it's kind of similar. So they have a tradition of remonstrance, which is that if leaders are doing a bad job, then the ministers of the leaders have a duty to criticize the leader. And the people as well. The people have a duty to criticize their leader. The people do not have a right to tell the leader how to rule, but they do have a right to criticize how the ruler is ruling. Do you see what I'm saying? Because in Confucian governance, the ruler is supposed to be like a benevolent parent doing what's best for the children. And the children have a right to complain, but they don't have a right to tell them how to rule. So you
might be crazy.
Think of that as a kind of free speech. But okay, let's these are interesting discussions. Let's continue them after we go through the life of Da Zuyuan. So back to Da Zuyuan. So he was born in Than Hoa in 1904. In 1925, so when he's in his early 20s, he's influenced by these movements to free Phan Boi Châu. We have talked about how Phan Boi Châu was arrested by the colonial authorities, and this really riles everybody up in the nation. So Da Zuyuan is influenced by this. So he admires Phan Boi Châu's patriotism. He knew him personally, Phan Boi Châu. And Da Zuyuan was also really moved by the funeral of Phan Chu Trinh in 1926. Remember, listener, Phan Chu Trinh, his death gave way to the first national funeral in Vietnam. Hundreds of thousands of people went out into the streets. Also in 1926, Da Zuyuan joins a Vietnamese revolutionary party. This is a time when revolutionary parties are popping up all over the place. So this party was called the Dan Viet Revolutionary Party, or Dan Viet Cách Mạng Đảng. And their goal was to, and I'm quoting, overthrow imperialism and build an equal and fraternal society. That's the goal. And then, so it was formed in around the 1926, but then it broke apart by 1929. Can you guess why? Because there were differences between people who were more communists and non-communists. Like always, we're beginning to see the split between communists and non-communists by the 90s.
Fun fact, in the 80s there, because you're telling me about Tân Việt, and I'm like, well, that sounds very familiar. And in the 80s in America, there's a big organization. I think it's still around. It's a really bad word. It's called Việt Tân. And they were all about overthrowing the communist government. And this was in the 80s, and I think it still goes on. But, you know, it's like a kind of a pariah organization today where people don't go near it. But Việt Tân was a big thing back in the 80s, and they were looking to organize to overthrow the government of Vietnam.
That is fascinating. They have the same name here.
They're switched around. Việt Tân.
Yeah. So Da Zuyuan's job in this revolutionary organization when it existed was to essentially find writings and ideas for the organization. So his job was like a librarian of that. So he created a publishing agency for the group, and he found a lot of Marxist writings. So he proposed that they build a library to teach the youth some elementary things about Marxism mixed with new science and social science to develop the thinking and ideology of the party. So he published 13 books, like he had 13 books published in this agency. And then he was arrested in 1929 by the French colonial government for this activity. And at that point, the press was suspended. So he was involved in newspaper writing as well. So between 1927 and 1943, he published a newspaper called Dinzen, Voice of the People. And what's interesting here is that he studied Chinese, Guignu, and French, and he was always improving that. And he was a primary school teacher at the same time. And it's interesting, I was reading some of his writings, and he's talking about how he had to study Chinese on his own. So he said there was no teacher, no books, so he would just borrow them from Chinese people that he knew. He would study them himself. And I'm quoting him here. He says, "I bought French books in Saigon and Chinese books in Jilin to build a bookshelf for the editorial board of the Dingzhen newspaper. I bought a number of books mainly on history, philosophy, sociology, economics, including some books on Marxism, such as historical materialism, historical economics, history of evolutionary anthropology, some books on Eastern philosophy and culture by Western, Japanese, and Chinese authors." Like, you just get a sense that this guy is curious. You know, he wants to learn about the world. And here's another interesting quote. He said, quote, "I believe that the Vietnamese revolution, if it wants to succeed, must ultimately follow the direction of socialist revolution. The socialism is scientific socialism or communism based on the theoretical foundation of Marxism, which means dialectical materialism and historical materialism." So you see in these quotes, he's compelled by Marxism. And this is interesting to talk about here because we're going to find out later that he's going to, you know, run into trouble with the party. So, okay, as I mentioned, he was arrested by the French in 1929. He's released a year later, 1930. And then he's going to work on his dictionaries and books about Confucianism. In 1945, that's the August Revolution. At the time, he's teaching history in Hanoi. And during the First Indochina War, he works for an association that's trying to uplift the literary arts. I'm just going quickly through his life here. From 1955 to 1960, he's the head of a history department in Hanoi. And in 1957, so this is where interesting things happen regarding the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng. So this is the period of the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng. Zhong Jin, one of the leaders, the Communist Party leaders, he denounces the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng. But no action is taken against Đào Duy An. So Đào Duy An is allowed to keep his teaching post. But we have to keep in mind that around this period, there are people who are being imprisoned.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
For their involvement in the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng. Now, in 1958, Đào Duy Anh does lose his position later, though. So, and then he just works on translation work. 1960s, we see harsher punishment for the people who were involved in the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng. So some went to prison for 6 years, some went to 15 years. The publisher of some of these magazines, they go to prison for 10 years. So this is a real crackdown on free speech here. And Đào Duy Anh dies in 1988. So that's his life.
I mean, in the big scheme of things, in the history of Vietnam, that is monster contributions that Đào Duy Anh does. I mean, just dictionary alone. And it makes me think, in order to even attack the job of putting together arguably this powerful list of words, you have to kind of know all these other subjects, right? Yeah. Anthropology and politics and economics and business. You have to really get it on so many different levels and understand French and Chinese and bring all these things in.
I mean, we had talked about Tham Quyên. Tham Quyên also had a vocabulary building project in the back of his journal, Nam Pho. He literally says, I'm going to help build Quốc ngữ vocabulary because our language doesn't have enough words to express all the important things in life. So he literally has three columns, Chinese, Quốc ngữ, and French, and he's creating the language in front of your eyes. So, I mean, this is really important for Vietnam. And it is interesting that, okay, so now let's talk about how he, what did he say during the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng? You know, how did he criticize the party? This is the interesting stuff. So let's get into it. If I could summarize it all for the listener, I would essentially say that his argument's really simple, which is that if you want to have a strong country, you need academia in your country to be strong. And unfortunately, academia in Vietnam at this moment, he says, is poor and backward. And the reason is because the political party leaders do not trust the academics. It's a really simple argument. And you listeners can disagree or agree, but I mean, what do you think about that argument that academic, a strong country means having strong academics? Do you even agree with that, Ken?
You know, I think about this often because I think that there is a time where I think academics or the power of higher learning can take it a little bit too far sometimes. I don't have any specific examples of this, but that's just my gut response. However, that being said, I don't think that there should be any control of higher learning and big institutions that feed the countries of intellectual thought. So I think there's a real balance in this question, Kevin, because too much of anything going in one direction, I think, can paralyze countries. I mean, I really do believe that. And I don't know where the line is. I'm not an academic like that. I don't understand, you know, if it even should be controlled. But sometimes I think having no guardrails will actually paralyze the country.
Yeah, yeah. Let's return to what you're saying here. Right now, what I want to do is I have a list of quotes from him that I find fascinating. And so I'm going to read some and pause and we can discuss. So let's get into the mind of Dazui Adno. So he says, in our country, dogmatism and the personality cult have driven people to present the theories of Marx, Engels, and Lenin or the views of Stalin in distorted ways to make it fit a framework. Let me give a recent example. In the debate about writing Vietnamese history and the formation of our country, many researchers did not dare to put forward new ideas that failed to conform to the theses of classical Marxists or of our leaders on these questions. Whoever stepped outside established frameworks found himself accused of some dire deviation and thus effectively shut up. What is he saying there, Ken? You're my student now.
I think we're going to, just for the sake of the audience, I think, can you repeat that one more time as I'm processing what you're saying and gives the audience a chance to kind of listen to this as well?
Yeah. In our country, dogmatism and the personality cult have driven people to present the theories of Marx, Engels, and Lenin or the views of Stalin in distorted ways to make it fit a framework. Let me give a recent example. In the debate about the writing of Vietnamese history and the formation of our country, many researchers did not dare to put forward new ideas that failed to conform to the theses of classical Marxists or of our leaders on these questions. Whoever stepped outside established frameworks found himself accused of some dire deviation and thus effectively shut up.
Okay. Yeah. So this is exactly, I think, what I'm saying about the academic institutions going too far. The frameworks that I think are laid out are so rigid sometimes that don't allow for true academic debate and academic freedom. And that is the thing that is causing paralysis, I think, at the levels of society where what I mentioned earlier, I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but I think in the idea of like professors and intellectuals being sort of the authorities in these academic institutions, it's actually controlling narratives in such a tight, rigid framework that doesn't allow for societies to grow.
Huh, interesting. So here, I think he's talking about how the leaders have a framework.
Oh, I thought he meant the academic institutions having a framework.
So he says of our leaders on these questions. So he's talking about the leaders, not the academics. So he's talking about how the leaders impose a framework on the academics and they say, here's how you must write about history. Mm. But the problem is that the leaders are not academics, so they don't know
how
to write about history. And so he's going to say the leaders are creating these frameworks and they're imposing, they're making them rigid. And when academics do say things or write things that the leaders think go outside of those bounds, they shut the academics up and then the academics don't feel free to do any work. And so they can't write good history, right? And so he says, I'm going to quote him again. In many fields of research or in discussion about any problem, many people have only one fear, that of inadvertently straying from the beaten paths of orthodox official thinking. To them, research is just a sport of tightrope walking at a circus. Research must be an immensely broad avenue through which everybody freely comes and goes, not a stretched wire on which ventures a circus artist.
Yeah, so I agree with him wholeheartedly. I think it goes for political leaders as well as academic leaders. In either direction.
That's interesting that you say that for the political leaders too. You don't think there could be too much freedom for political leaders?
I think when you have any direction being, you know, it going one way too much, I think it creates this rigidity and we lose nuance, I think.
Yeah. So essentially here he's saying that if you're a researcher, you need a broad avenue. You need freedom of thought in order to think and to do research. I mean, this really makes a lot of sense. Like, if you want to do research on any topic, you also need access to information, right? You need to be able to get material from the internet or in a library to do research. But if you don't have access to information, then that literally prevents you from thinking about things, right? We can only think when we talk with others. You cannot think alone. I think I've talked about this on this podcast, but you literally need somebody else to hear what you say out loud and then for them to give you feedback and then for you to develop your thoughts. Anyway, so his point here is that academics need to not feel constrained. And when party leaders instill fear in academics of having to say the right thing, it's doing really bad things to research. So he says, one must root out dogmatism and the personality cult to liberate research. One must apply the policy implemented by the Chinese Communist Party in this area. Let 100 schools contend. One thing that I find fascinating here is that just to go back to a quote earlier, he said that people are distorting the ideas of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Stalin. So it already like is setting him up to say, like, I am a good Marxist, you know? It's you who are distorting the views of these communist saints, right? So,
and I wonder if he said it at the time just to fall in line with the party.
That's a good, yeah.
You know, are you saying this just to fall in line with the party, or do you really mean this? Because there's so much restriction with these communist saints that he's coming from. It's like, it's kind of ridiculous, you know? Yeah. And I think when we think about the power of a nation, and I think about the United States, you know, you could debate about recently, but, you know, typically in the history of the United States being its powerful self. And then you think about countries that have a limited, reputation for power. A lot of it comes from this idea of free thought, being able to really, really have the ability to move thinking and thoughts around freely is what makes the United States such an attractive place in the past, is because you can come here and you can say anything you want, basically. I mean, it's the freest country. Can you believe that?
Yeah, man.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. To innovate anything, you need a contest of ideas. That's where innovation comes from.
Yeah.
So, but what you brought up is a really important and good question. Is he saying this sincerely when he praises Marx and Engels and so on? So some people are going to say, like Huan Wenji, he's going to say, the members of the Nianwen Zaifeng only pretended to support the party in order to criticize the party. But of course, we are not them. We don't know what's in their hearts. We just know what they said, you know? So these people are proclaiming to support communism, etc. Another thing that I found interesting was him talking about freedom of speech. And what he means by that is a really interesting way of talking about freedom of speech, because that's not how we talk about it in the United States. He's essentially going to say that if we really want freedom of speech, what we need is the freedom and ability to publish. Like if you say, hey, Kevin, you have freedom to write, but you don't give me any pens or paper, do I really have the freedom to write? You know, if you say you have freedom of speech, but one guy can have a microphone and I don't have a microphone, do I really have that freedom?
Right.
Real freedom is in the material ability to express that. So he says, most of the means of publishing, distribution, even the means of research and creation are concentrated in government agencies. Therefore, the problem is not about fighting for freedom, but to fight for practical assistance of the government to create conditions for the implementation of those freedoms. For example, practical assistance for publishing, distribution, creating a research, care for widespread publication of literary and artistic works, et cetera, et cetera. So he says our regime in the government and the people are of one mind, he says. This is interesting. He says, in our regime, the government and the people are of one mind. What do you make of that? What is he saying?
See, that's toeing the party line to me. You know, what was he able to...
But he's trying to say, like, this is our goal, you guys. This is, and I actually think it's a good goal. The government and the people should be of one mind. That's the goal. And it's your fault that the goal isn't, that it's not being that way, you know? You are straying away from the people. You claim to serve the people, but you're supposed to serve the people. So you could actually use the government's own arguments against itself. Wow. Like, I mean, I'll say it, like, if you look at Ho Chi Minh's writings, what he says is often great. Even my dad and even a lot of anti-communist people, you point to a quote of Ho Chi Minh and the anti-Ho Chi Minh people are going to say, yeah, but don't believe what he says. Look at what he does. But what Da Zui En is doing is he's saying, no, but hold them up to the standards of what they say, actually. That's how you can criticize them.
So, oh, there's a lot here.
Yeah. So he goes on to say, even in academia, so what he calls scientific research, nianqiu kuahao, political, okay, this is really interesting. I want to talk about this. He says, even in academia, political standards are needed because we do not think of having non-political scientists. But what kind of political standard should be required? Is it necessary for a scientist to be a party member? This is really interesting, Ken, because essentially he's saying, should the professors, should the scholars share the same politics as the party? And his answer seems to be yes. Like, the scientists and scholars should be Marxists, essentially.
Yeah. I completely disagree with all this.
Let me just finish what he's saying, and then I want to debate with you and play devil's advocate, etc. So he says, okay, he kind of concedes, and he says, yes, our scientists and academics and scholars should have political standards, but what standards, and how do we know? I'm going to quote him, is it necessary for the researcher to be obedient, is it, or clever, or flexible, or less combative, meaning less troublesome to superiors? Should we reject those who are combative, or should we set broader standards? So he's throwing all these questions where he's basically going to do that clever thing that I said, which is that share the same goal, but then, like, question, you know, make a lot of freedom to that goal. So it's like, yeah, they should be broadly Marxist, but how do we figure that out? You know, like, what kind of personality should they have? And so he then says, I would like to raise the issue of learning from other countries. In the process of building our universities, we need to learn from our friends, especially the Soviet Union and China, which are teachers in many aspects. We need to sincerely learn from the experiences and knowledge of our friends' experts. But should we use our sense of national inferiority to deny the creativity of Vietnamese experts? This issue also needs to be discussed in order to carry out learning creatively, not falling into the evil of mechanical and dogmatic learning that can cause harm. This is what you were talking about in episodes ago, where you were saying that it seems like in Vietnam, there's a rigid learning style where you just memorize things, right? You're just dogmatic. So he wants them to avoid that. He wants them to learn from abroad. And he's starting with China and the Soviet Union, you know.
Which are strange examples, you know. So if we're making sacrifice in academia to toe the party line, that can't be good, right? Because
what he's saying,
that's what he's saying. It cannot be good. And I don't know if this is this alternative that I'm about to bring up, if that's any good either. But there was a writer, some people, you know, you can also probably classify her as a philosopher, but Ayn Rand wrote Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, and really talked about the person, the individual, taking it to the extreme, pedal to the metal, really redlining, just getting yourself to perform at your best, no matter how much challenge government gives you, your superiors give you, your own family gives you. You just got to go at your, what is inside of you, and take it to the, it's the exact opposite of what Dao Zuyan is talking about. And I don't know if this is a relevant conversation to bring in, but objectivism as from where she's bringing it is diametrically opposed to what Dao Zuyan is saying. It's like, no, individualism and your own volition to pursue academics or anything creative is paramount, is the most important thing, not towing the government or the country's line. That's not what we should be doing.
I don't share my opinion often on this podcast, but I'll say that I think Ayn Rand's ideas are a complete disaster. I mean, she is promoting a super dangerous kind of individual selfishness. I mean, she takes pride in that. Be selfish, be an individual. If everybody were to act like that, our society would just collapse. You know, like,
there's definitely a middle ground to all of this. And I think going one way or the other way,
I would agree with you there that we do need to balance, find a way to balance individual freedoms and need and the good of society.
Yeah, absolutely. But I agree with you. If I think we're seeing the destruction of American society as a result of this doctrine 50 years, 70 years later, 60 years later, we're seeing it corrupt families, and we're seeing it corrupt the fabric of the United States.
I mean, this individualism, like even libertarian thinkers, like philosophers like Robert Nozick, he's one of these greatest, most important philosopher for libertarians and individualism. Later in his life, he wrote a memoir, which is a great memoir called Examined Life. He literally says, I used to have these ideas about libertarianism and I realized I was wrong. There are certain things in life that require a spirit of solidarity and community. There are certain projects that we must undertake in common. It's like, I just got back from Seattle where I saw a friend who just had a baby, you know, and you've had kids, and people who have had kids know that you have to care for the baby there's so much care and love that you need to go into raising humans. None of us are these individual do-it-yourself people. We always need people. Anyway, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole of individualism and collectivism here. But I do want to turn back to Dazuyan and say a really interesting part here where he talks about why he thinks Vietnam's academics are inferior. So he says, we must admit that our current academics are inferior in the cause of economic and cultural construction to build the democratic Vietnam in the direction of socialism. Academic work, scientific research work, plays an important role. Because if this work does not develop, then economic and cultural construction cannot go far. Our task is to find a way to make this work meet the construction needs. This is fascinating. He's saying that, look, we're trying to build towards socialism, and we need to be able to do research in order to help that happen. So he says, political party leaders have always been prejudiced towards intellectuals. The leaders think that the intellectuals are too influenced by the bourgeoisie and the landlords. and that the intellectuals have a landlord mentality because they learned from imperialist countries. The leaders hoped that the intellectuals would establish an attitude of unconditional service to the people to wholeheartedly serve the resistance. But political leaders distrust the intellectuals. The leaders insist on leading the intellectuals, but they are often inexperienced and tend to exceed their authority and encroach on professional control. This is so funny here. So, I mean, one last quote. The encroachment of political cadres and leaders into professional fields like the natural sciences is, of course, a great obstacle to professional scientific research. In the field of social sciences, the problem is just as serious. Because social sciences are more directly under political leadership, it's easy to mistakenly think that anyone with a strong political stance can do social science work. Therefore, we see many cases where either purely political cadres, we see them borrow professional titles and they lead academic organizations. And in this way, scientific research work is difficult to conceive and guide correctly. In short, it's the ideology of distrust and contempt for intellectuals that has led to the distorted application of the very correct principles of political leadership. And as a result, our academic work in both natural sciences and social sciences has encountered many obstacles and is still stuck in a state of backwardness.
Now, Zian is putting it down, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So this is really, if I could sum it up in my own words, I mean, he's essentially saying that for the country to develop economically and culturally, it needs a strong academic sector and research sector in the social sciences and in the natural sciences. And to have those, you need freedom to do research. But these party leaders who are not educated, essentially, he doesn't want to say it out loud, right? But these are not people who have not been trained in history or the social sciences, and they think they know better than the professors. And so they clamp down on the professors, and it's really just shooting the country in the foot. You know, the government is acting against its own interests. Now, here is where I want to have a debate with you. So earlier you said that there should be separation between academics and political leadership. This is interesting because if you think about the question, who has the right to educate our youth? That's in many ways the most political question ever, because that's the same as, like, if the youth are the future, that's essentially asking who has the right to shape our future? Who decides what values to instill in the youth who will be in the future, right? Whoever teaches the youth is creating the new society. So when I teach personally, Kevin Pham, when I teach, and this is my own style, I do not try to impose any political ideologies or values. Listeners might know by now, I like to present different sides, and I get in trouble for it by different sides on this podcast, right? When I quote somebody who's a communist, sometimes an anti-communist thinks that it's my opinion, but no, I'm just quoting the other person.
But Kevin, Let's be honest. I think academics or religious leaders can present in ways that, because the questions that we ask and the people that we highlight and the quotes that we pick out, these things highlight a very specific direction, no matter how much we think.
I was about to say everything you're saying right now. I was about to say, I do this, and still, this itself is imposing a value. It's the value of taking perspectives. Maybe it's not good to take different perspectives. Like, and also some would prefer that I say that Marxism is evil, or some would prefer that I take a position, and that if you don't take a certain position, the point I'm trying to make is, me included, no matter who you are, you're going to be either unconsciously or consciously promoting some value. And so the question becomes, should that be led by a political leadership?
I think it's impossible to separate the idea of politicians leading the country's education sector. It's impossible to, because let's just say in a fantasy world, politicians are representing the voice of the people. And the voice of the people oftentimes are saying what they really feel. And they don't agree with some of the academics. They don't agree with what kind of political thought is being infused into the youth. So the cycle of controlling the politicians, you know, in a perfect world, is the people that are controlling the people who are teaching the youth of tomorrow. So I think it's a question of balance. Who controls the youth? It's usually the people, right? Our society that we live in that vote in the politicians, and we trust that the politicians will control the narrative of academics. I mean, we're seeing that play out now in America. You know, they're banning books, they're resetting curriculums in elementary schools. They're bringing God back in, they're bringing prayer back in. And these are not all bad things. And I think taking a lot of the things out of gutting the...
Wait, hold on. When you said these are not all bad things, can you clarify what you mean by these?
I think that we have got to have the ability to have freedoms to, if we want to say prayers, if we want to put this idea of God back into the conversation. I think there has to be some room for that. I don't know how, but there's got to be room for that.
Right. But I don't think banning books is a good thing.
That is a bad thing. We know that is a bad thing.
As long as we're clear on this.
No. That is the bad thing. But that's what I'm saying. All of this stuff requires so much nuance and dedication to have both sides seen. We have to be able to not control the narrative and not say, hey, that book needs to be banned. We have to be able to say we can't limit academic freedom and academic thought. And this is happening in the U.S. in a way that I think it's not good either. I think anytime you try to over control an environment, it's not good. It's not good for growth. It's not good for humanity.
Yeah. At the same time, you know, we could also just think of this as a struggle between groups of people with different values.
Yeah. You know,
and they're going to fight to get professors who think like them into power. And that's what it is. It's a struggle. So that's why when we talk about free speech, what's interesting about the term free speech is that if you went to any college campus today and you asked random students, what do you think of free speech? My guess is that if they're on the left, they're going to be suspicious of the term because they think that free speech is something for conservatives or right-wing people. But you know what? It has not always been that way. Free speech used to be something for the left. It used to be a value on the left. Think about the free speech movements like in Berkeley in the 1960s. It used to be a leftist value, but then the right wingers kind of co-opted it, and now the left wingers don't want to attach themselves to it, which I think is a huge mistake.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Anytime you try to control a direction, I think that's a mistake.
Yeah. So free speech is kind of like a prize. You say that you want free speech until your opponent uses it and it benefits them. And then at that point, you're like, no, no speech for you, you know, only free speech for me.
You know, I am delighted that you took this direction today with Dao Zuyan. You know, it helps shape the idea that Vietnam has this towering intellectual figure that really did his best to kind of introduce some sort of framework of pursuing, you know, the dictionary science And I think that I never knew that that existed. You know, that's a really powerful thing that there was somebody at the forefront of, you know, organizing all this information for us.
Yeah. Yeah. He is an impressive figure.
He really is. You know, in one of the comments I saw, you know, somebody said, you guys promised to do Madam Mew, you know, and there's probably a lot of people and figures that we promised to do, but I'm glad and I'm very happy to have this sort of departure. And I think, Kevin, I think we should do more of these, you know, the departures, you know, somebody in science, somebody in the arts, and how it affected the political kind of outcomes of Vietnam in the last 100 years.
Yeah, I agree. More to come.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.